Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 175 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast with iTunes or other podcast apps. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. We have a really long interview this week, so let's get right to it. Tricia Morrison is the widow of Tommy Morrison, the famous heavyweight boxer whose career was cut short by, supposedly, a positive HIV test, just before a big fight in Las Vegas. It was February the 10th, 1996. Instantaneously, he became a pariah and unable to box. 10 years later, he tested negative, but it was too late to regain his career. He later died due to surgical malpractice, but a lot of the world thinks he died of AIDS. Here to set the record straight is Tricia Morrison in her first appearance on The Infectious Myth, although I did interview her before for my How Positive Are You podcast some years ago. Welcome to the show, Tricia.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. It's good to talk to you again. So were you and Tommy together on the, were you a couple when his boxing career came to an end, or did you come along later?
Well, actually, I was in Las Vegas in 1996. I was handling a lot of British tourists from the UK into Vegas, and I was in charge of hotel accommodations, and I couldn't get any hotel accommodations for a certain night, and that was the night that Tommy was supposed to be fighting. So when the fight got cancelled, it completely ruined tourism for me, so I was not a couple with Tommy in 96, but since 1996 until I met him, I actually, to be honest with you, couldn't stand the guy, right? Because he had ruined my business in Vegas for that one night.
Right, right.
So it was just coincidental that we did hook up later on, yeah.
Yes, so it was a one-night disaster, you might say.
Yes.
So everything you've learned about that night in terms of the HIV test and things like that, you learned afterwards. I guess that's what I was getting to. So what have you learned? Who did the test? What kind of information is available about the test? Who was it who pronounced that there was a diagnosis of HIV positive? What have you learned about that?
Well, I've learned a lot, actually, and a lot of the stuff, I'd say probably about 99% of the stuff that I've learned, Tommy never even knew about when he was alive. So when Tommy did pass away in 2013, I just started to ask questions because I had been told that he did not have HIV and also that he had no AIDS-defining diseases. And this data came to me from experts in the field, from pathologists, from infectious disease physicians. So that's when I started to ask questions in 2013, and I'm still asking questions, and I'm getting the answers, and I'm getting the answers direct from government officials, CDC, FDA, places like that.
Right, but let's just focus, because a lot of stuff happened after 96, but let's focus on 96. So what kind of test was done, who did it, and who pronounced that this meant that he was HIV infected and therefore unable to box?
Right, yeah, and it appears that in 1996, the tests that he was given were given by Quest Labs, the affiliated company of Quest Labs in Las Vegas. And it happened to be a commissioner from the Nevada Commission, not a physician, that came to a third party in Vegas and said, Tommy has tested positive for HIV. Get him out. Media is swarming. And that's how it all began for Tommy. So he never knew what tests. He never got any kind of report. He never met with a physician. Nobody did. And he was immediately flown out of Vegas to Tulsa, Oklahoma. The way it was handled in 96 was just atrocious. You know, it would be just like the janitor, you know, taking information from somebody else and handing it to somebody else that you're about to die by the time you get to your car. And that's how it all began for Tommy.
So there was no medical doctor who said, I've looked at all the information about this test, everything looks kosher, and on that basis, I diagnose him HIV positive.
No. And in fact, from 1996 to 2013, it was the same tests that they used in Vegas, of which they all have packet inserts that say that they don't diagnose, and they don't diagnose the virus HIV.
Was this an antibody test, like an ELISA plus a Western blot?
It just depended on the physician. There is a ongoing lawsuit right now, David.
And right.
You know, my attorney says I can do interviews so long as I state the facts. So in front of the court, when you ask what tests they were, well, it just depended what the lab decided to do on the blood samples. Now, of course, we don't know whether it was Tommy's blood that was taken. I mean, there's no chain of custody on any of the stuff, right, between 96 to 2013, other than a blood draw in 2012 and 2013, where blood was actually taken from Tommy and tested specifically for the virus, and nothing came back. So looking back at the tests that he was given, In some places it was just the ELISA, in some places it was just the Western blot, and in some places it was just the PCR viral load. So there's actually no consistency throughout his whole life. And when you look at the lab reports, which, by the way, are not a diagnosis, I've just found out, you'll see that they all differ.
Okay,
no consistency.
So you've raised a lot of issues. I believe that the Western blot, even today, takes considerably longer. How long before the fight was Tommy tested?
You know, and that is an excellent point there, David, because, you know, you look at the lab report, which finally got printed in 2014 for the lawsuit. And when you look at that lab report, it will say when the blood was collected, when it was received, and who it was reported to. All that stuff is written on this piece of paper that they've regenerated somehow, although they said that they had purged it years and years ago. When you look at that lab report, it's got a physician's name, which it should always have a physician's name on there, of the physician that ordered the testing.
Right.
Well, the physician's name is not the physician that ordered the test. And in fact, that physician, his name is Dr. Robert Voy, great guy in Las Vegas, never ordered those tests, yet his name appears on the lab report. And on an email from his attorney, he clearly says Dr. Voy did not diagnose Tommy Morrison with HIV. So even if you're going to assume that physician ordered the test in 96, the physician is actually flat out saying, Tommy did not have HIV. I did not diagnose him with HIV.
You've discovered an interesting thing, like something that I'd never really thought about before you started digging around in this area. But the basic process, I understand it, is that that a doctor says there's some reason to suspect you have HIV, so I'm going to order a test. So they fill out a form, take some blood, send it to the lab. The lab runs the tests and sends it back saying, maybe HIV reactive with whatever tests they are, ELISA, Western blot, viral load. There's a bunch of other tests, and they will say whether it was reactive or not. Now the doctor will sit down with that person and say, you are HIV infected, I would imagine most cases, but is that a decision of the doctor, or is it the doctor just saying, well, if the test is reactive, I'm going to assume the lab diagnosed you? Who does the diagnosis?
Throughout this lawsuit, there is not one affidavit, David, from any physician that says, I diagnosed Tommy Morrison with HIV. They are all pointing to a lab report that was generated by Quest Labs. And Quest Labs is with their left hand saying, pulling that lab report, saying, no, no, you know, don't look at this lab report. It's not a diagnosis. It's not to be used for treatment. You know, so don't look at our lab report. But then again, with their right hand, they're shoving under the noses of the judges the lab report, saying, look, here, see, he was HIV positive.
So the doctors are dumping responsibility on the lab, and the lab is dumping it on the doctors.
Well, the only person that's taking responsibility, or should be taking responsibility, is Questlab, because they are printing off what the physicians are assuming is a ready-made, custom-made diagnosis for that person. Now, the only problem is that the physicians don't know about the packet inserts. They don't know that the tests don't detect the virus. They don't know that the tests also will test positive or reactive on people with lupus and 80 other, you know, diseases and disorders, and on animals and cows and ants and plants and stuff like
right.
that. So the physician doesn't even know what tests they're ordering. They basically get a test requisition form, check a box, take some blood, send it off to the lab, and actually the attorney in Vegas for the physician said, physicians do not diagnose. They're not responsible for making a diagnosis because it's the tests that were purchased by the lab. It was their tools that actually did the testing. It was their technicians that did the reporting, and they're the ones that authored the lab report. Got nothing to do with the physician because the physician never saw the blood being tested.
At best, a physician can just see a piece of paper and say, okay, the piece of paper says you were reactive on two ELISAs and a Western blot, therefore I diagnose you HIV infected, but it's just a piece of paper.
Right, yeah.
What I've seen is that they generally say reactive, and that is something that has to be interpreted. And like you say, if you read the test labels, it will tell you all the caveats about that, that there's no gold standard for HIV testing, and this test alone cannot be used to diagnose HIV. All of that
right.
gets forgotten.
You know, the lab report will print reactive or positive or negative or non-reactive. Those are the wordings. But I've never, ever seen a lab report that says indeterminate. Right, or false positive or false negative. And that's impossible for them to do because Quest Labs don't get to see the patient. They don't have the patient history. They don't know the clinical symptoms of the patient. They've not done 80 to 100 differential diagnoses of Tommy. They're not licensed to practice medicine, as far as I know. They're a lab. They're under CLIA. Regulations, but I don't believe that they're actually allowed to make a diagnosis for a patient. You know, the tests that Tommy did were supposedly the ELISA and the Western blot and the viral load. And my information that came back to me from the FDA is that each of those tests do contain packet inserts. And throughout this lawsuit, not one person have said that they ever saw a packet insert. And quite honestly, I never saw a packet insert at all until I started to look into this between 2014.
I was very interested in HIV test packet inserts because they include so much damning information about the tests, but they don't appear to be used by the laboratory except for maybe the part that tells them how to perform the test. Once they figured out how to perform the test, they probably never look at the test insert again. But if you're going to diagnose somebody as HIV infected, you need to understand all of the limitations of the test.
The FDA acknowledged that the commercial tests on the market are just a tool to aid physicians. And, you know, in order to make a diagnosis of any disease or disorder, the physician has to have the clinical symptoms, patient history, and also must have ruled out other disorders or medical issues that could have triggered a reaction off the test that Tommy was ordered. And between 1996, definitely in 1996, in Las Vegas, none of that was done. In fact, the clinical symptoms of Tommy Morrison on his physical report by the physician was 100%. He was 100% in condition, and the doctor checked off, is physically and mentally fit to receive a license.
You mentioned the chain of custody, but I would imagine that when a doctor did an HIV test, that they would, they would take a number or some identifier and put it on the vial of blood, and that would be reported by the laboratory so that you know that there's not been a mix-up. Was there anything like that in the case of Tommy's 1996 test?
Not that I know of, David. Nothing like that has come up in this lawsuit at all.
Tommy being thrown out of boxing was a pretty big economic hit for Tommy, to say the least. I mean, he went from potentially multi-million dollar paydays to a nobody, economically speaking. Were there people who would have benefited from Tommy's career being turned upside down?
Yeah, it was a multi-million dollar contract that he had just signed with Don King, who is a special promoter, let's put it this way, for in boxing. And the fight in Vegas in 96 was the first of a multi-million dollar fight contract. So not only did the commission cancel that fight on that night, but they also medically, indefinitely, worldwide suspended Tommy from boxing. He was supposed to meet Mike Tyson in the third round. Of fighting, the third fight. So, yeah, it was a huge hit.
So,
but not only the money side, you know, there's the stigma as well. You know, you can lose all that money, but then it carried on to huge depression of nobody wanting to shake his hand or breathe the same air as him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty tough for a celebrity.
Right. I mean, that's a huge fall. They could hardly hide it because Tommy disappeared, so there were going to be questions about why is Tommy not fighting, and there are only so many possible answers. He's been injured. He's HIV positive. I'm starting to run out of possibilities. I did interview Tommy once, and before 2013 when he died. I don't remember when it was. And one night he found a book on his porch. He didn't know how it got there.
Yeah.
And it was
That's
a book
right.
questioning HIV and AIDS.
That was down in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma,
at his ranch.
Yeah.
Somehow a book in a brown paper bag got to his porch through a gated area where he lived without a dog barking. And inside the brown paper bag, he found it at 3 a.m. in the morning, was a book called Deadly Deception. I think so,
yes. Wilner was the guy who injected himself with HIV-positive blood in public.
Yeah, and so he read that book all night and, you know, started to, you know, research it.
How did viral load tests fit into this story? What did you find out about them with Tommy?
Well, I found out... Obviously, after Tommy had passed away, I contacted Roche Diagnostics, and everybody's really been very helpful, David. You know, I'm asking the right questions. I'm asking questions that they know the answers to, but quite honestly are not publicly available. And I contacted Roche, and I asked them about viral load tests and, you know, do they detect HIV, the virus, and you know, are they used for diagnosis? And I got an answer back actually directly from them saying, no, they don't. They've never been licensed to diagnose HIV or HIV infection. And in fact, just recently, as last week, the CDC came back to me and told me exactly the same thing. So again, in this lawsuit, David, for somebody to hand me now, a lab report, first of all, I know now that a lab report is not a diagnosis, but then to hand me a lab report with a viral load which is what they call it, even though it doesn't measure a virus, it means nothing. It does mean nothing to me, and it shouldn't mean anything to the judge.
When did Tommy get viral load tests?
Well, it appears that there's a whole bunch of viral load tests right in front of the court, in the court documents. You know, you're welcome to public knowledge. You can retrieve them because I've not hidden anything. I've not sealed any documents. Mm-hmm. Now, in this lawsuit, you cannot fight Tommy's case without everything being uncovered. Now, there's only one thing that is covered, one thing that is sealed, and that's paperwork from Dr. David Ho in New York. That's the only thing that the defendants have kept sealed that I have fought and said I want unsealed. But for some reason, they come back to the judge and say, well, you know, the defendant, Dr. David Ho, doesn't want to be sued. Well, why should I sue him? Just open up and let's see what he's written there.
If it's sealed, it's still available to the court. Is it available to you? Will you get to see it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got to see it because they sent me a copy of it.
How does that protect him against the lawsuit?
Exactly. It doesn't make any sense, right? And basically, I've asked, you know, the judge to unseal that document, have Dr. David Ho on the stand and explain that document and show us if he isolated and purified a virus from Tommy. I mean, Dr. David Ho runs this huge operation in New York, and he should be able to give us the answer of how, if he did, ever find a virus in Tommy.
Have you
so
ever noticed
the only one sealed document?
Have you ever noticed this about powerful people? Is that they strut around saying that they have awesome powers in whatever domain of the world it is, and they have this incredible amount of knowledge, and whether they're politicians or doctors or whatever. But then when somebody challenges them, all of a sudden, they were in the important meeting, but they weren't paying attention, and they don't remember anything that happened in the meeting. They may have signed a piece of paper, but they didn't read what was on it. You know, that kind of stuff. They all of a sudden become the most incompetent people in the world.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to dog Dr. David Ho. I'm sure he's a pretty nice guy, you know, as well as, you know, Dr. Gallo and Anthony Fauci. You know, this case brings all those names into Tommy's case. Anthony Fauci from the NIH, Robert Gallo, who is claims to be the discoverer of the virus, and Dr. David Ho. And then there's a Jay Levy guy on the West Coast. These
right.
are all people that are part of Tommy's life. You know, whether they're part of anybody else's life, I honestly don't care, right? But they're part of Tommy's life and what happened to Tommy. So I don't care if they're a celebrity or a politician.
Right.
You know, I go directly to them.
Well, they're all people who are supposed to be. I mean, let's run through the list. So Tony Fauci has run the NIH, I think, since 1984 or something. So the entire AIDS era, this one man has been at the top of what is the major medical research funding organization in the United States. As you say, Robert Gallo published papers in 1984, in May 1984, in the journal Science, claiming to have found the probable cause of AIDS. It was later discovered, all kinds of things had happened. He'd stolen samples from the Pasteur Institute, and when they actually gave out the Nobel Prize in 2008, they spurned Gallo, and they gave the Nobel Prize to Luc Montagnier and Barry Sanusi, who was also in the Pasteur Institute lab. And Jay Levy was supposed to have isolated and purified HIV just after Gallo and Montagnier. He was a little late to the party, but is also supposed to be one of the top AIDS researchers in the world. So this whole questioning process you've been through has caused you to question the whole idea of HIV isolation and purification. What is your current, what have you learned about that, and what's your current opinion about HIV isolation and purification?
Well, actually, the FDA, who I spent the last 4 or 5 years working with, Very nice guy, Walter Gardner. He's the chief of consumer affairs. Just just been really great, and hopefully he's listening to this show. He's given me a lot of the answers that I've been asking for, and I believe also that he's learned a few things himself. He was on one of the last emails that we had. He sent me a representation of what the virus looks like in its isolated form.
Okay.
And purified form. And I thought that's great. You know, I thanked him very much. It's a depiction. It's a cartoon sized drawing.
So by representation, you're talking about a creation of a human being. You're not talking about an image of something real.
Right, exactly. It's a drawing. So if you were to draw a picture of a flower and send it to me, that would be great. But then I go back to you, Dave, and say, that's a nice drawing, but send me the actual photograph of the flower that you did the drawing from, right?
Right.
So it was real interesting when the FDA sent me the circle virus with everything in it, and that's exactly what I wanted. But then I went back and I said to the FDA, that's really nice, that's great. You've pulled it out of the AuraSure, which is a test kit company, packet insert. It's on page 12. Thanks so much for sending me that information. But what I'm looking for is actually the real image that's found in the human body that looks exactly like that. You know, and I said, you've hit it on the head. That's exactly what I'm looking for. And I'll be quite honest, you know, Dr. Gardner, or not even a doctor, Mr. Gardner, that because they never found any of that in Tommy, that's why I'm looking for it. It's because I'd be happy to provide you with the actual real image, but they never found that in Tommy.
Was Tommy's blood put under an electron microscope to look for the virus?
Yeah, it was, because you know, when you think about it, none of these tests detect the virus.
Right.
And that comes directly from the FDA. There is no test that detects HIV. And HIV, I found out, stands for human immune deficiency virus. It doesn't stand for human immune deficiency virus antibody, right?
Right.
HIV stands for the virus. So, you know, in order to find out, now knowing that you know, that these tests don't detect the virus, obviously you've got to be able to detect it some other way. And you know, it's just logical that these tests never existed when Dr. Robert Gallo found the virus himself. So
which tests didn't exist?
ELISA, Western blot, and viral load. None of them did. You know,
one of the interesting things the Perth group found is that, Robert Gallo's trying to find if there's a particular virus in the body of people who have AIDS or pre-AIDS or whatever. And he, part of these experiments, he used rabbit antibodies to HIV, but he hadn't yet proven that there was an HIV. So he was kind of caught in this circular reasoning. In order to be able to produce antibodies in a rabbit, you would have to take pure HIV and inject it into a rabbit. That would mean you'd have to purify HIV. But Gallo never did that, nor did Montagnier.
Yeah, and I've found that in my research. I've actually tried to get a hold of Luc Montagnier, I think his name is.
Yes.
And I believe he's somewhere in China, but I haven't been able to contact him direct. I've made contact direct with Dr. Robert Gallo's office and even the dean of where he works. And as he knows and will publicly state, you know, I reported him to the dean because he couldn't give me the information I wanted. So, you know, the isolation of the virus, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a physician. I'm just somebody wanting to see what the virus looks like that's been separated from all the other debris in the blood and photo-imaged and cut up and chopped up so we can see exactly what's inside that virus, which I can't find. And I'm still trying to find it. And it's not being a denialist. I'm actually going directly to the various government entities and also to the people directly involved in it from this discovery to get that.
What you're really asking for is Koch's postulates, which have been stated a number of different ways, but Robert Koch was a bacteriologist from the 19th century, and he basically said that you need to purify the pathogen, whether it's a bacteria or a virus. You need to inject it into a susceptible animal. You need to produce the symptoms of the illness, and then you need to repurify it. And in 1937, Thomas Rivers, who was at that time one of the top virologists in the world, stated, "It is obvious that Koch's postulates have not been satisfied in viral diseases." But then went on to say, well, we don't actually need Koch's postulates. He says that what we need to do instead of Koch's postulates is satisfy two conditions. First, the specific virus must be found associated with a disease with a degree of regularity. Secondly, he says, the virus must not be shown to occur in the sick individual as a incidental finding, but as the cause of the disease under investigation. So one of the things he's saying is, in order to prove that a virus causes a disease, you have to know ahead of time that it's the cause of the disease, which seems impossible. But things have not actually improved since then.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, actually, with my little investigation that I'm doing, I found out that there was a paper written in 2016 by Robert Gallo et al., you know, there's a few others that wrote it with him, in a science journal called PNAS, I think, P-N-A-S. And I think it came out in November 2016, where Robert Gallo himself says, well, you know, it's really hard to separate the virus from EVs. So I then Google and find out what EVs are, extracellular vesicles. And then in his paper, he goes on to say, you know, they're the same. They've got RNA. They've got the same proteins, except that they're not viruses. They're not infectious. So right there in November 2016, it's almost kind of like a disclaimer to me saying, oops, you know, it's really hard to separate them. Well, you know, nowhere in the paper does it say how he separated them. Nowhere does he say that he actually pulled out the virus and isolated it. What he's saying throughout the whole paper, basically, is that, you know, the virus actually looks like an EV. Well, you know, then we have a problem, Robert Gallo, because you told my husband, basically, in 96, with your, published papers, that he had a virus. Well, if you've never, ever isolated it from these EVs, how do you know my husband had a virus? How did you make
that? Well, yeah, like if you consider making an antibody test from this material, you would do this, you would produce this so-called concentrated HIV, which has been known since 97 to be at least 90% impurities. And then you would generate antibodies from exposing blood cells or some other materials to this material. But if that material contains non-viral proteins and non-viral RNA, the antibodies that you produce might have nothing to do with HIV, if HIV is even present. Like, it's crazy.
Well, they don't. They don't, because the tests themselves say that. You know, if you've got plants and animals like cows and flies all testing positive on the so-called antibody test, then they're not specific to humans. You know, this HIV that Tommy was told he had is a human immune deficiency virus. Human being, it's only found in humans. Otherwise, it wouldn't be called a human immune deficiency virus. He was told he had that. They never found that in his system. And apart from that, when he died, I have found that the tests that he was given from 96 to 2013 have packet inserts that say that it's not specific. So with the case of Tommy is that no one at all has produced a packet insert in Tommy's case that shows the facts. And the facts are that the tests, the so-called HIV tests that he was given, are not just reacting to humans. They're reacting to other things like animals and insects, as I've mentioned before. So that's where the problem lies, is the facts are there, but they're not available to the public. And that's a big problem.
Yes. Another test that you mentioned in some of the material you sent to me is the CD4 test. And this is not an HIV test, but it's considered to be a test that reliably indicates the health of the immune system, even though it's known that that's not true. Was Tommy given CD4 tests, and what did they show?
Right, yeah. Well, that's another thing. In front of the court, you have an ex-wife saying that his CD count was really low. You have a report, maybe from a physician, saying that his CD4 count was really low. Then you have a lab report from Quest Diagnostics, again, showing the ratio between a CD4 and a CD8 count in Tommy. But what I've found out since then, and definitely Tommy was never informed by anybody, by any physician, is that having a low CD4 count or even a high CD4 count doesn't mean that you have HIV. And this has been confirmed to me by the CDC themselves. So that's another test then. In fact, they even state that in 1996, there were no CD4 count tests. So if you're going to base the whole thing that Tommy had AIDS based on a CD4 count, then in 1996, how could you ever tell anybody they had AIDS?
Well,
if it didn't exist.
I think they're playing word games there, because I don't think there was a test you could purchase in 1996 for CD4 T cells. But it was something that was done in the labs, and we were talking about this earlier, and I don't think AIDS would have existed without the CD4 count, because they needed something where they could tell you that your immune system was trashed. I mean, the problem with CD4 counts are numerous. One is that there are many things that cause your CD4 counts to go up or down that have nothing to do with HIV. Another problem is that there are people with very low CD4 counts who are perfectly healthy. And HIV negative, so it's got nothing to do with HIV. So why they latched on to the CD4 count, I don't know. But CD4 counts do tend to go down when you get sick. And they do tend to come back up again afterwards. So there is some correlation with sickness. But they needed something where they could scare people into saying, your immune system is garbage now, so you need to go on the drugs. And that seems to be the major purpose of the CD4 count test.
Right, that's right. And also the scale appears to have changed. You know, at the time in 1996, there was no CD4 test. So, you know, nobody could say, well, you're above or below 500. And then later on, it seems, well, you know, because you're under 500, you've now got AIDS. And then a little bit later on, it was, and now you're under 200, you've got AIDS. Well, I've asked for the backup to that information. Show me, you know, the proof that if Tommy had under 200 T cell count, that he would have AIDS. Where's all the scientific facts to that? And I'm still waiting.
Right. I mean, it's definitely true that people were doing CD4 count testing before 1996. I have a paper here from 1986. Talking about CD4 counts and CD4 CD8 ratios, and it's part of the definition of or it's included in the diagnosis of of AIDS. So I don't know what the CDC is telling you, but I think it's something maybe irrelevant.
But you've got to look at the MMWR that the CDC bring out. There is a paper that they brought out, which is their way of communicating with the medical establishment. It's called the MMWR, and there's certain volumes. There is one paper that they issued that specifically stated, that a CD4 count is not a diagnosis of AIDS.
I agree with that.
Not a diagnosis. It's just used for surveillance purposes. First of all, you have to find out if that person is infected with HIV before you even can claim to use a CD4 count to diagnose a person as having AIDS. And in order for that person has to have the perfect clinical symptoms of somebody of dying of AIDS. Well, look at Tommy. If you look at pictures of Tommy, David, you'll see that his fighting weight was always 224 pounds, around about there, right? Even when he died, he was just under 200 pounds. He wasn't skin and bone or anything like that that, you know, people will imagine that he probably was. You know, the only time that had lost weight is when he turned to drugs, hardcore drugs, because of the stigma of HIV, right?
Right.
And in fact, the CDC state that if you have been a hardcore heroin user or cocaine user, you can never use a CD4 count to say that, you know, Tommy Morrison has HIV or even AIDS, because that person already has a shot immune system by using those hardcore drugs. So the CD4 count.
I understand what you're saying, but I think the CDC is playing games. I accepted the CDC surveillance case definition for AIDS as the definition of AIDS. But then somebody pointed out, well, it's just a surveillance definition. What does that mean? Well, they want to do statistics. So they want to know how many people with AIDS there are. So then I said, okay, well, where's the other definition of AIDS? Where's the clinical definition of AIDS? And there isn't one. And so basically, doctors use the surveillance definition, which as of 1993 in the United States included low CD4 cell counts. If you had a CD4 cell count below 200 or 300 without any symptoms of AIDS at all, you were diagnosed as AIDS. And this had huge economic impact. It meant that you got drugs. It meant that the city that you were in got funding. There are all kinds of reasons apart from your health for this. And the CDC is very important for deciding how funding is applied around the United States. But for them to say that this is only the surveillance definition, it's not the clinical definition, well, then it brings up the question of what is the clinical definition of AIDS? And if there isn't one, how does anybody get diagnosed?
Right. Well, in this case, in Tommy's case, and again, I'm going to keep, you know, sticking to Tommy's case. I'm not here to fight anybody else that has been, you know, given a diagnosis of HIV. But in Tommy's specific case, nowhere do they state, you know, on the defense side, that MMWR paper was brought out by the CDC saying that you cannot use that CD4 as a diagnosis. Nowhere does it say that. Not even their expert witness, who is Bernard Branson, who used to be a CDC employee. So he should have disclosed that information. He did not disclose that information, nor did he disclose the fact that you can have a low CD4 count based on autoimmune disorders and other disorders or diseases, etc. In fact, that ETC was included in this email directly from the CDC. As far as the court records go, none of that was brought out. And this is what I need the facts. They need to come forward with the facts that I have been given directly from these government agencies. There's no reason to hide it. You know, and
right. Who is helping you in this lawsuit?
On what side do you mean?
Well, on your side, in like gathering information, interpreting information.
Oh, okay. Well, me. It's been me gathering the information for the past 4 or 5 years, and getting emails, getting information, trying to find out what has been going on with the testing that was used on Tommy, and what a lab report is, what the tests include, what they do not include. So I've been doing a lot of the groundwork. I find it fascinating, absolutely fascinating. You know, I would like to just be given that, you know, that real image of the virus on its own with all the stuff in it. And anybody that's listening, send it to me. You know, I have an email address, TommyTheDukeMorrison@yahoo.com. Send me the image of what the virus looks like, and then I can use that. There is an attorney now on board, I'm happy to say. The case is in the Court of Appeals, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, and we're waiting for the judges to come back and, you know, for a rehearing.
Do you have an expert witness or two?
Yes, I do, yeah. Actually, I had two. I had an expert witness in Vegas who was actually the CEO of the lab in Vegas in 1996. He was there that day, and he disappeared.
He disappeared
off the case.
There's a lot of strange things about here. What about your other expert?
Yep, my other expert witness, you know, the day that he had to do his expert rebuttal witness report, he got like between 50 and 100 phone calls a day, threatening calls and threatening his family, car broken into. Why? You know, why, David? You know, his life was perfectly normal the day before he did the expert witness rebuttal report. And then that day, he's only stating the fact. He's only stating exactly what he's been given. He's an expert rebuttal witness, unbiased. He's not biased on my side by any means. That's what an expert witness is supposed to be, is unbiased.
Supposed to be, yes.
But his life was turned over upside down. But he's not giving up. He'll be there with me.
And can you tell me who that is?
And then, absolutely. He's done an interview with me. His name is Dr. Jonas Moses. PhD.
Okay.
He's been involved in, you know, other lawsuits actually too as an expert witness. So he's not going to say anything that's untrue. You know, he wouldn't do that.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you have his assistance.
Right. Yeah. And then I have an attorney who is an attorney that's based in Vegas. You got to remember, you know, Tommy was a celebrity. This is going back to 1996. And all that anybody's ever heard of was Tommy Morrison diagnosed with HIV in 1996 in Vegas, kicked out of boxing, died September 1, 2013 of AIDS because he was diagnosed with HIV in Las Vegas. Well, if you look at the timeline, they never actually, now 20 years later, say that they ever diagnosed him with HIV. So it's just real interesting. And as far as the timeline goes, David, when Tommy died on September 1, I had them draw blood. They asked me. When he passed away...
2013.
2013. Yeah. Yeah, September 1, 2013. When Tommy passed away, they asked me, it was at 11:50 p.m., I remember it so well, they asked me if I wanted an autopsy. And I said, absolutely, but I want a blood autopsy because, you know, for all these years, they've been saying that he has a virus in his blood, that he has this blood-borne disease, and I just want you to draw the blood, and I want you to look for the virus. That's all I want. And they drew the blood, and the infectious disease doctor up in Omaha, Nebraska, who's worked on HIV and Ebola and all this stuff for 33 years, wrote out the requisition, and the blood was sent to the pathology department, where a pathologist has worked with Robert Gallo and had told me a few months earlier, before Tommy passed away, he said, if anybody can find the virus, it will be me, because I've done it before. I know how to do it. So okay. I thought, great, September 1, blood taken. Finally, you know, after all these years, we'll find out if Tommy ever had HIV in his system. And to me, that was his post-mortem blood autopsy. Well, September 4th, 2013, the death certificate comes out. And on the death certificate, it says cardiac arrest, septic shock, septicemia from Pseudomonas, which was caused by 12 foot of surgical gauze left in Tommy's chest in 2011, 2012.
That's pretty shocking.
Because
that's pretty shocking.
Failure.
Sorry, yeah, I keep talking over you.
Yeah, and multi-organ failure because he was put in a coma two, three days before he died. So that's what came out on his death certificate, that September 4th. Now remember, September 1 he died at night. September 2 the media went absolutely crazy. All over right. the world, David. I mean, literally all over the world. Tommy Morrison, you know, diagnosed with HIV in Las Vegas, 1996, died of AIDS, you know, late last night. Well, no, he didn't. You know, hey, guys, we're still waiting for the blood autopsy, the post-mortem report to come back. We don't know this for sure.
And did it come back?
It was too late. Okay.
Did the
so September 17th, 2013, I got a call from the infectious disease doctor that had ordered that test, and he called me. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I remember the actual moment. He calls me from Omaha, Nebraska, and he says, "Mrs. Morrison," and I go, "Yeah." He said, you know, this is Dr. Smith, you know, University Medical Center in Nebraska. And I go, yeah, hi. He said, we got the results back. And I go, yeah. And he paused and he went, literally like that, David, I don't understand it. And I go, what don't you understand? He said, negative, no virus. And I said, thank you. You know, this is the best hospital in the nation. It's one of the four top hospitals. It's not some rinky-dink lab called Quest Labs doing this, right, with a technician that's probably just been employed for a week. This is one of the top four best hospitals in the nation where there's something wrong with the president, they get flown there. That's how good this hospital is. And
right.
So I said to him, okay, well, you know, thank you for doing that. Would you please, you know, send me the report? You know, and I'd also asked for the photo images of his blood at the same time. I mean, I wasn't
right.
going to mess around. If you're going to do something, you ask for everything.
Right.
So the next day, I go and stand by a fax machine, and they fax me the report. And it's a pathology report, David. Now, you're talking to me, the widow. I've never seen a pathology report. I've never
right.
seen a lab report. You know, what's the difference? Well, the difference is that a Quest lab report is a clinical lab report issued by a lab, which is a corporation. Quest
right.
Labs Incorporated, right? That's that.
Right.
It's not a diagnosis. That's what they say, right? So I'm comparing that now to what I just received over a fax machine from an infectious disease doctor, right? A physician that's been in the business 33 years. You know, I'm not in denial. I'm reading what a physician wrote to me and a pathologist wrote to me. And on there, it clearly defines exactly what they saw in the blood. It's not just doing one specific test. It's like a goldfish bowl. You are seeing exactly what's inside Tommy Morrison's blood. And not just once, but lots of slides. So if you're going to say to me, well, you know, there can't be enough virus in his blood, well, no, you know, because a vial of blood under a microscope should be able to see exactly what a vial of blood for a viral load test then, right?
Right, the same quantity.
Exactly. If you're going to tell me that that vial of blood has 330,000 viral load or 70,000 or 20,000, then I'm going to be able to see exactly that under an electron microscope. And you can't tell me that there's not enough virus, right?
Right.
So clearly on that lab report, it says no viral particles, no budding retroviruses, and I've learned, you know, in the 4 or 5 years that HIV is a retrovirus. So no budding retroviruses, no abnormalities, no viral particles. And that's how the pathologist and the infectious disease doctor came back to me on a test specifically for the virus. And if you've got a virus, you'd obviously have antibodies created by that virus. Came back to me on September 17th, 2013, no virus, nothing. And on September 18th, I get the pathology report. And so, you know, by then the whole world has gone crazy. And I've never dealt with this before. You know, when somebody normally has somebody die, you're there, you're on your own. But I have the world attacking me, saying, no, she's in denial. Well, guys, you were not there for 21 months with him as he suffered all these things because of a stupid surgeon in Tennessee leaving 12 foot of surgical gauze in my husband's chest
right.
for 1 week and not telling anybody. And me, Tricia Morrison, is finding it. Not a pathologist or anybody. I'm finding that 12 foot of gauze in his chest.
Right.
You guys weren't there when they drew his blood. You guys weren't there when you took the phone call from an infectious disease physician. And you guys were not there when I received the pathology report. But I've been so open with this, David. I've shown the world the pathology report. I've shown the world how you 12 foot of gauze comes out of somebody's
right.
chest. Right? You know, I'm happy to share that with them, so that they can see that proper people eventually, at the end of Tommy's life, discovered that he did not have HIV. Apart from the fact that within the 21 months of his life at the end, I had him tested for everything to
right.
do with AIDS. And they all came back negative, right?
Right. We have to leave it there. But at the end of Tommy Morrison's life, there was no HIV in his blood.
No, none whatsoever, and that came directly from the experts in the field.
Right. Good luck with your court case, and as it progresses, maybe we will talk again.
All right. Thanks so
Thank
much.
Thank you, Tricia. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 175 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.